The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
My name is Ryan Caulfield, and thank you all for being here today and participating in the conversation between the Free Library's very own Jason Freeman and the very talented Brian Cranston. I'd just like to remind everybody before we begin that the books are pre-signed, and we will not be permitting any flash photography. Let's be respectful and keep our phones silent. And, well, Brian Cranston is here to talk about his memoir, A Life in Parts, and it's definitely a book, if you haven't picked one up already, you definitely want to get a hold of as soon as possible. I've already read it, fortunately, and I have to say, I was actually surprised. It's very well written, and it's very smooth to read. I mean, I knew he was a great actor, but a writer, too? That's usually a surprise, but he's definitely on the ball there. But as you read A Life in Parts, you'll see that, you know, Mr. Cranston, he's always transforming himself, you know, through all the roles he's doing. Like, he mentions when he was working on Malcolm in the Middle, all he had was a short description for who Hal was, basically a hairy father. But he made the role his own, you know? He made him the lovable, absent-minded man-child who likes to roller skate to Funky Town. And then it's just great. And we get Breaking Bad, and I don't even have to tell you about that role. Like, everybody knows about how many awards he's gotten, how amazing he's done on the show, just transforming from Walter White to Heisenberg. And that was a first for television, just having a good guy at the beginning of a show and then gradually just becoming the villain. And you leave the viewers wondering, am I supposed to be rooting for this asshole or what? So, but the book goes into so much more detail about his life and his family and how he turns his failures into successes, how he seizes every opportunity that he can get a hold of, and how he goes from all of his roles, A Life in Parts, right, from, you know, son to brother, husband to father, and actor to director, and now a writer, too. And we all know him best in one role or another. Some of you, when you see him, may say the name Trumbo or Tim Whatley, or LBJ. Most of you probably say the name Hal or Heisenberg. But if, when you see this man, you say the name Brian Cranston, you're goddamn right. Let's all welcome Brian Cranston to the stage, everybody.
What do you mean you were surprised that I... Wow.
You want an honest answer?
Yeah. Thank you, Mini Trump. For the hair, not for anything, just the hair.
And I quote, I'm gonna burn that kid when I go out there. Welcome to Philadelphia, home of Mike Ehrman Trout.
That's right.
So I see that a lot of you have this book, and I can't tell you, based on the intro and based on, I think, of what we all know about Whatley, LBJ, Walter White, you'll be delighted, but you're going to read this book, and you're going to find out those things, yes, but so much more. And one of the emotional cores for me in this book are the early sections that deal, you're 11, 12 years old, your father leaves, you, your brother, your sister, your mother are picking up the pieces. Can you talk about what that did to your family?
Wow, it's devastating. I don't think I'm really unique in that sense. A lot of people come from broken homes. But when you're 10 or 11 years old and what your memory was up to that point was a cohesive family unit where my mom was den mother and, you know, she was the team mom for Little League and she made our Halloween costumes. She was really hands-on and really a fun, loving woman, engaged and attentive, loving. And my dad was this, of course, you always think of your father as being bigger than life and robust and masculine, and you're always looking up to him because you're small. And he was this great guy. And then at 10, it started to wane. By 11, 11 and a half years old, he was gone. He left the family. He had a midlife crisis of epic proportions and took off and, you know, left his family completely. So I didn't see him from the time I was 11 and a half or so till the time I was 22. So the other side of that is my mother, it was the love of her life, and she was devastated and emotionally crushed, and she self-medicated to cope. And so she was then emotionally detached from me. And so all of a sudden, it created a vacuum of emptiness. And at an age, 12 years old, where you're just starting to wonder who you are and where do you belong in the world. And so, you know, you felt the pressure and you felt the uneasiness. And this is in a time when, you know, it wasn't common that people broke up all the time. Today, if you said my parents are still married, they'd go, "You're kidding." Really? Wow. That's wow. But back then, of course, it was, if you came from divorce, it was a scarlet letter, too. And then on top of that, we lost everything. We lost our house. We got that big red notice on our door, you know, being foreclosed. And we were kicked out and split the family. My brother and I went to live with my maternal grandparents for a year. And that's in the book as well. But I do want to say that despite what you are going through at the time, there are always lessons, aren't there? I mean, so we went to our grandparents, my brother and I, kicking and screaming. We didn't want to, oh, awful. In the middle of nowhere on a little gentleman's farm, he was a retired baker of German stock, very tough, old world kind of guy. And we had chores, forget television, that's over. You know, it's like, so it's chores and things, and one of the episodes in the book is how through a rite of passage he was teaching my brother, who was 2 years older than me, and myself, how to kill chickens. And so at the tender age of 12, I was in charge of murdering chickens. And so those... But the silver lining is that anytime there's conflict in your life, it makes a good story later on. So now I try to tell my daughter that whenever she's going through a hard time, it's like, ooh, yeah, but just remember, this is going to make a great story later. I know, right now, it's not good. I get it. But later, you know.
I'm not joking. I can mark out chicken murder story.
Oh, okay.
And can you actually tell briefly the story, the first time you're standing there with your grandfather, you know, you're freaked. He gives you the hatchet.
My brother being, I guess, you know, that this is how it happens, right? If you're older, you go first, you know? And so here, he did it a couple times. There's a piece of wood on chopping block. He grabs a chicken, one hand, both wings and the feet. Boom, chicken's down there, head's there. Whack! Head falls off. He drains the blood in a blood bucket, finally, then throws the carcass into a big bucket. Next. Bam! There it is. This is how you do it, kids. All right, he hands the hatchet to my brother, and we're petrified, and he's holding it, And my brother goes up and he closes his eyes just before. And he hits it through the chicken's comb. And hits it. Wham! And it sinks into the chopping block. And the chicken's like, ah! Like this. There was little salvation in knowing that the chicken probably didn't feel it because a comb is like hair. So it's like, it's just caught, and he knows something's weird. This is not a normal day of pecking at food on the ground. Something's going on. And then he, my grandpa, oh, for crying out loud, give me that. Like, here's how you do it. Whap, you know, and then, oh, okay, now do it again. And my brother is like, oh, and he finally does it. And I'm petrified now. It probably would have been better to go first because the time it took, I'm like, like, and he hands me the hatchet, and now I'm going and I'm shaking, and I thought, oh, okay, I can't mess this up. I can't mess this up. I go in, I grab the chicken with two hands, and then bring my hand down so I'm covering the tips of the wings and the legs with one hand. I can feel the spur, that opposing, you know, little digit they have kind of digging into my hand. I don't care. I'm going to take that. Down it goes. I'm not going to close my eyes. Here it goes. I look up, and that chicken's looking at me. And I remember going, like, sorry, I'm so sorry. so that my grandfather wouldn't hear it. I'm so sorry. And then I just said goodbye, and I was like, whap! Off it goes. Boom! Down, I held it, it's shaking, the central nervous system is working, and I'm holding it, and the blood is draining into the bucket, and like this, and I'm like, okay, just hold on, and one of the wings got free, so now it's like this, and then the other one got free, you know, like this, and it dipped down, and I'm trying to hold it so the blood wouldn't go outside the bucket, because he would have been mad if it had, so I'm holding it down, and the wings dipped into the blood, and started to the... Now I'm holding it, and blood is shooting up in my nostrils, in my ear. I look like that Carrie, you know, with the blood bug. I'm holding this thing, and then it got loose, and then I couldn't see anymore, and the chicken's running around, you know, and bumping into things, and my grandpa's going, oh, for crying out loud, you know. Yeah, and my brother said he was stunned, and then he went over and he took the garden hose and washed me off. It was just petrifying. And then later on at dinner, my grandfather told the story, and now he's laughing because even him. Comedy is tragedy plus time. And so at dinner, he's laughing and telling my grandmother, my grandmother's laughing. And I'm like, yeah, that was me, so.
I was really looking forward to hearing that story live. So I think obviously after experiences like this, it very easily translates and segues into a variety of your childhood and young adult jobs. I started making a list, and then there just became so sundry, wedding officiator, lifeguard, and police trainee and security guard. And one thing I really like about this book is it's peppered, the first half of the book especially, your experiences coming up, not making it, and the people you meet along the way, and it really informs later how you treat people. Robert Forster from Breaking Bad, for example. You worked on a movie that he was on. What were you doing on that movie?
It was called Alligator in 1980. I got a job as a production assistant making, you know, $30 a day for like 14 or 15 hours and a box lunch. So Robert Forster was the star of the movie. And I never had an occasion to talk to him, nor would they want me to even get close to him. You know, it's like you try to keep them separate, that sort of thing. And someone from the special effects department came over and said, we need a PA for special effects. And I raised my hand because I thought it would at least be better than to driving back and forth to the production office with paperwork and stuff. So, okay. So I became the assistant to the assistant's assistant. So I was on the bottom rung, and my job was to mix the blood that would go in. You see the theme?
There's a theme, yeah. I'm building to a
breaking. See the damage caused? So I was in charge, big vats of Karo syrup. You remember the Karo syrup, right? Tinted red. And the viscosity of Karo syrup was like blood. It has a thickness to it. And so we chunked up bits and pieces of foam rubber and shards of soft rubber, plastic that looks like bone fragments and sinewy, you know, ligaments and things like that. And we put them in huge, they didn't even have 1980. I don't even think they had Ziploc, but we created our own kind of Ziploc kind of thing. And we put, just filled these huge bags with this blood and guts mixture. And I'm getting into the carcass of the alligator. This, okay, the alligator, it's haunting the streets of Chicago in the sewer system. It's a true story. And killing people, you know, here and there, as alligators in sewer systems would want to do. And pretty soon the police who, they didn't, oh, come on, it's not going to be a big alligator. And Robert Forster's character says, it is a big alligator, I promise you. So I'm stuffing this carcass, the test alligator, with all these bags of blood and guts. And then the director would come by when I'm done, and we'd blow it up. And we'd blow it up, and then he invariably said, not enough blood, more blood. It's not nearly enough blood, you know. So we made more and stuffed the alligator with more, and the final sequence is where Robert Forster uses himself as bait to draw the alligator close to him, and then he scales up in through the manhole just as the explosives are ready to go off, and the final sequence is this big alligator blowing up, and I made the blood. So it's like kaboom! But during that time, there was one moment when we're on a van being transported down to the sewer to shoot, and there's two different areas where I was stuffing the alligator and where they were shooting. And Robert Forster got in the van and he sat next to me, and I was like, I shouldn't talk to him. Don't talk to him. Okay. And he looked at me and he goes, hey, how you doing? Bob. And I go, hello. What's your name? Oh, Brian. He goes, what do you do, Brian? And I go, I'm just a PA working, stuffing blood. Oh, that's cool. He said, just a PA, that's all right. You know, he just had a really great comportment and a really friendly demeanor. And I remembered that. You know, I was just a kid. I was 22 years old. And then you flash forward, Robert Forster, and I didn't know this. It came about this way. Flash forward many, many years, 30 years. Robert Forster in Breaking Bad was in the penultimate episode where he played the disappearer, the person who put me in the truck and got me away, and then I begged him to play cards with me, and he said $10,000, and you know, and we're doing that whole thing. That was Robert Forster, and I reminded him of how kind he was when we were in the van. I said, do you remember getting in the van? He goes, no. Do you remember sitting next to a production assistant? And you were talking, no. And you don't expect him to. It was my memory, not his. You know.
Right.
Anyways,
life lessons.
As sweet and kind still then as he was back earlier.
Right. Plus another life lesson always, more blood.
More blood.
Right. This is what really, really strikes me in the book. And you read it and your determination, your fortitude. I'll leave this anecdote for you, but you learn to rappel, like rock rappel for a commercial, and all of these people are terrified to do it. But one thing that I found really, really incredible in the book is you say, for the first time, to say, you were able for the first time to say that you were an actor. You just turned 26 years old. You were a working actor. To this day, that remains, quote, my proudest professional accomplishment. Can you talk about that and why it feels that way?
You know, when when you enter into the arts, it's a daunting journey. And there are, I'm sure, people here who are actors and writers and people, or wanted to be, or you have children or nieces and nephews who are going to enter into this, and it can be a daunting experience. I had an experience where I had this epiphany that I wanted to be an actor when I was 22 years old. I was on the Blue Ridge Parkway in Virginia riding my motorcycle. It's in the book too, but that's not the question you ask. So, but
we'll get back.
Well, but you know, I did bit parts here and there, and you know, clerk number two, and you know, party boy all these kind of weird little no name titles and things like that. And you're working in little bits and little bits, and you're doing a commercial, you're doing an industrial film, you're just trying to make ends meet, you're trying to pay your rent and pay for your classes and things like that. And you hope that at some point there's going to be a transition from that feeling of I'm an outsider and sticking my foot in every once in a while to I'm an insider. I belong here. I feel right. I feel confident that I now can and will make my living as an actor. And I thought that was always my goal. If I can make a living doing something I love to do, oh man, that's the best. And so at 20, I was 25 and then turned 26, that happened. I moved to New York with a job from Los Angeles to be on a soap opera. And so it wasn't really the soap opera really that did it. It was just that I was getting affirmation that someone else saw something in me too. Even a corporation said, yeah, he's the guy, let's go with him for this role. It just made me feel empowered and confident. And now, many, many years later, that's what I look for in actors when they come in to audition for something I'm producing or directing, is a sense of confidence. Not braggadocio, not that, not bombast, but true self-assurance and confidence in what they're doing and presenting themselves in their work, and then leave. Then you're done and go home. And if you don't develop that as a young actor, then you are in trouble, because there's a likelihood that you could develop a sense of resentment and anger, and that will start to erode who you are and your soul, and you wither away and become a miserable person. I'm not naming names, but there's several people in the audience. Just saying.
Certainly some of my library colleagues. Kidding, you guys.
Just threw them right under the bus. Wow.
They would have done the same to me.
Nasty.
We put a pin in this. It's for me, the clearest, most evocative section of the book. You talked about it. You were all over the country with your brother on motorcycles. You end up on the Blue Ridge Parkway. You're stuck in the rain. Can you tell us about that experience and what it led to?
Well, just a quick preface is that having no guidance, I didn't know what I wanted to do for a living. My brother joined a thing in Los Angeles called the Police Explorers out of LAPD. And the reason he joined it, because he thought he could, they said, we travel a lot. So we're poor kids from a suburb. And the idea of getting out of your situation was incredibly enticing. And sure enough, after he joined, they left. They went to Hawaii one year. They went to Japan the next year. It was like, as soon as I was 16, I'm joining. And I did. And I had to go to the LAPD Academy 8 Saturdays in a row to study protocol and police procedures and that sort of thing. And I graduated first in my class. So all of a sudden, I stumbled upon something that I had an aptitude for, and I was grateful that, and then, okay, I guess that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to be a policeman. So I went to college, and my second year in college, I was taking an elective course of acting, and I'm segueing. I'm kind of doing a roundabout to it, but and I discovered something even more important than police procedure, and that was girls. The girls in acting classes were much prettier and much more accessible than the ones that were in police science. Go figure. You wouldn't think that. I know. But it was true. And so it started to spin my head around, and I had some ability in that. And the joy of working with these young ladies, and it was so much fun. My first assignment in my first acting class in college was handed to me at random, depending on where you might be standing. And the first thing was, a couple is making out on a park bench. And I look over, and the girl's really cute, and it's like, oh my God, oh my God. So we did this whole make-out session, and she was totally all over me. So I'm in. This is great. I start forgetting what I had studied. What, police something? Was that? I don't know what it was. At the break, I went up to her and I said, hey, that went pretty well, I thought. And she goes, yeah. And I go, so do you want to have lunch? And let's have lunch sometime. She goes, oh, no. No. I have a boyfriend. And to which, of course, the default to any embarrassed young man is, that's fine, that's cool, all right, it's all right. You feign indifference, am I right? You go, yeah, fine, cool, I'm good. I got lots to call, She walks away and I'm going, oh my God. So two things, she's kissing me and kissing me and kissing me, and I'm thinking, she really loves me. I mean, she's so into me. And I realized, oh my God, she wasn't at all into me. She was acting, and I completely believed it. So the power of performance was spinning me, plus the sensation of this girl was kissing me, and I was like, oh, it blew my mind. So I did the honorable thing. I ran away. I jumped on my motorcycle. My brother was kind of in the same position. And we left California, and we traveled around for 2 years. Getting, it's the 70s. Remember that? Well, some people, many Trump won't remember the 70s, but...
Burn.
It was huge. Huge. That I can tell you. That I can tell you. Okay. So you could get a job. It wasn't as litigious, right? You can get a job here. We got jobs in restaurants and carnivals and anywhere. You can get a, here it's 20, bust these tables, okay? And you could do that. And there was some freedom to that. And so now we're traveling around and traveling around. I have this book of plays, because on a motorcycle, you got to be very careful how much you pack. You don't have a lot of room. Book of plays. So my brother and I had a series of signals when we're riding our motorcycles, and we were on the Blue Ridge Parkway, gorgeous, coming down, fall, and it starts to rain. I mean, really rain. Pre-GPS, we're thinking it could be 30 miles, it could be 60 miles to the next town. We don't know. So what we did see was a sign, picnic area, 1 mile. And we signal to each other, let's get off until the rain stops. Good idea. We get off, we go down to the creek. There's a slab of cement, 4 posts and a roof and a picnic table. We put our motorcycles right up onto that slab and waited out. Got a little late, so we stayed the night. And the next night. And the next night. And the next night. And the next night. It was 6 days of solid rain, rationing Top Ramen. You remember bouillon cubes? Postum, Sanka, Rye Crisp crackers. So and saltines. So anytime we were in a restaurant, you order a soup and then you grab all the crackers. You know, because it's like what you did. You know, it's just, that was going to make a meal. So we had to ration everything out, and it was it felt like you were imprisoned because you couldn't leave. It was just pouring rain. But it gave me an opportunity to just do some reflecting, and I was going into my book of plays, and I was reading Ibsen's Hedda Gabler, and I started it, and it was day, and I'm reading it and reading it and reading it. By the end of the thing, I found myself in a position where I was leaning, and I was leaning because there was one sodium light in the middle of this compound about 75 feet away, and that was the only light source, and I didn't notice that. I had never before missed the transition from day to dusk to night while I was awake. Sure, if you slept through it, you slept through it, but while you're awake, you missed going from day to night? How is that possible? And I realized it was the transformative power of storytelling. It took me away. It not only allowed me to eat up some time because we were stuck in this place, but I was imagining being in that room and imagining these characters and going with it. And so I had this epiphany at that moment that I wanted to pursue something that I loved and hopefully would become good at, as opposed to pursuing something I was good at but didn't love. And so that was the turning point for me, that it was like, okay, I'm in. And like in poker, I'm all in. There was no fallback. It's like, here I go, the uncharted territory.
That is wonderful. All right. And I sort of made a conscious decision to leave all of your, you know, Hal is Walter conspiracy theory questions for you guys. So this is pretty much a good place for me to stop. But garnered from the bowels of the internet, Facebook, and my wonderful library colleagues, I have a quick speed round. So two people asked me this one, so I'll ask it first. You played Buzz Aldrin in the HBO miniseries From the Earth to the Moon. Cary Elwes played Michael Collins. Cary Elwes, cool guy?
Cool guy.
Good to know.
And Tony Goldwyn played, yeah.
Excellent. Wit or without, which is Philly speak for how do you take your cheesesteak?
With or without the cheese?
Whiz, yeah.
The whiz, yeah, without.
Okay.
Sorry. Deal with it.
We'll get security. All right.
I see some head shaking, like, boy.
Well, on that note, favorite curse word? This is a First Amendment shot.
It's actually a phrase now. Grab a pussy. No.
The Malcolm Gladwell tipping point happened here. It happened today. It's in the vernacular.
That I can tell you.
Any role you could play, regardless of age, gender, race, anything, any role.
Well, I'd love to play Trump. I think he's, you know, he is a classic modern-day tragic figure. And they're great to play. They're wonderful.
How much fluoride should our dentists use?
It's not so much how much fluoride, it's making sure you floss.
Okay. What would Tim Watley tell us?
He would say, oh, yes. He would say, I'm not an anti-dentite.
The answer we were looking for is shtickle.
A shtickle of fluoride. Right. Oh,
do you
I
have
see.
A party trick?
Do I have a party trick?
Yes.
No, I have an after-party trick. I load the dishwasher better than anyone I've ever met. You can't beat me. Don't try. When you're a guest in my house, I'll only redo your load on the dishwasher. Sorry. It's just not good enough.
Okay, that one was mine. This one is not mine. Have you seen Aaron Paul naked?
Oh, God, thank you, no.
Okay, right.
No. Emotionally naked.
Right. And I think somebody will probably ask about this, but boxers or briefs?
Well, tighty-whities, I guess.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are going to open up the floor to you guys. We have volunteers with microphones here. Please raise your hand, and I will call on you. We'll get this gentleman first, and then on this side, we'll get that gentleman.
How you doing, Mr. Cranston?
I'm good.
I just want to say first that your work is tremendous. It's fabulous.
Fabulous.
You know it.
It's
I know
huge.
It. Everybody knows it. Believe
huge.
It. Look,
there's
okay.
My...
China.
There's
okay.
My
it's,
friend.
It's China. Okay, it's more.
Yeah.
She's huge. What's on your iPod?
What's on my iPod?
Yeah.
You know, I'm actually deficient in any progressive music. When I write, I always listen to classical music. I love Vivaldi. Anything that kind of takes me away emotionally. I also then, I get into jazz too. I love jazz. But then my go-to, if I want to sing, is like classic rock. I'm a classic rock fan. But I'm not very progressive. So, yeah, whatever, you know, I mean, whatever that entails. Yeah.
Cool.
Fabulous. It's good. Thank you for your question.
Sir?
Thanks. Great socks, by the way.
Oh. Thank you.
Welcome. When you prepare for a role you're about to take on, do you steal from other roles or from other characters that you've become? And specifically, when you did LBJ, did you steal anything from Walter?
Not consciously, certainly. You want to see if you can divorce yourself from other characters you've played. And in fact, the more distinctive a character is, the easier it is for you to make that specific. It's not easy, but it's easier because with LBJ or Dalton Trumbo or someone like that, they're so dynamic in their own uniqueness that then there's so much that you can dive into and pull out. But for me, it's always what's the emotional center of a character? What's the core? Once you get that, then everything springs from that. And you don't want to get to a point where you judge your character. So as many people would say, you know, they would tell me, you know, I hated Walter White or he became this horrible person or something. It's like, oh, really? Oh, okay. Yeah. Because in my body, in my mind, I was justifying everything that he was doing, you know, even though we know and objectively we talked with Vince about when we make this transition, we have to include the transition of his ego. He was not in touch with his ego when it first started. He didn't even know how he felt. He was numb and depressed. But then once he was re-stimulated by this life, and that's the double-edged sword, it made him feel alive and powerful. But as it got to when he killed Mike, and sorry for those who never saw him, you'll forget that. It was ego that did that, because Mike insulted him. And the old Walter White would have walked away fuming, but the new one would have said, to hell with you. I'm not going to take that from you. And, you know, it was a transition constantly. And you're looking for those things, those idiosyncrasies and characteristics of every character, and hopefully pull them into your own pocket.
Hi, my wife and I saw you as LBJ when you were in New York. All we can say is, you hit him with the hein. When you were on Howard's show.
That's an inside joke. Right, hit him with the hein.
Okay. You're a big fan of Howard Stern, and you've been on the show a couple of times. Is there something behind the scenes that you could tell us about being there as a fan, as opposed to just being there, you know, promoting, telling your story?
Behind the scenes, he's so open, you know. He's a great interviewer. He really gets a chance to get in and open you up and make you feel comfortable. He has really honest, revealing interviews. I think that's what I like most about it. It's fun to mess with his staff too, and JD, I always make fun of him, and I always perpetuate this thing that I'm angry at him, and it's fun. I'm going back there again later this year. I was going to go for this book tour, but they're on vacation this week, so that's that. But It's a lot of fun. Thanks.
Well, their loss. Our gain. Young lady, yes.
Oh, she's the Seinfeld fan, right? She's holding on to the
already.
Wall. Are you okay?
That's embarrassing. No, I'm a little nervous.
That's all right.
But I want to know what's new.
Oh. So. Sup, girl?
No. I'm talking from Seinfeld. Like, tell me what's
new.
I'm coming. I'm Seinfeld into you right now.
You're Seinfeldian. Yeah. Okay. Let me tell you a little story about Seinfeld. Right.
Oh my God, that would be the best thing ever.
Good.
I'm asking. Of course.
Yeah. I get it.
So go there.
Okay.
Go for it.
All right. You're okay. Working on that show, which I think is one of the greatest comedies ever, brilliantly cast, but also incredibly constructed to incorporate four main characters, and each one had an agenda on every episode, and then they intersect throughout the episode and come to a conclusion. Unbelievably difficult to be able to execute. And it changed everything. No, you know. Then you look at shows where people are sitting around just talking, and you go, "Why are they just sitting around talking? How come everybody doesn't have an agenda to work on?" Anyway, but working on the show was like going to comedy boot camp. It was amazing, and I was hired as Tim Whatley, the dentist, because in the callback, I made Jerry laugh. He was there in the room, and I made him laugh, and that was like, ooh, that's a good sign. Yeah, you make the boss laugh. That's good. So I got the job, and if you'll notice that every time you saw me, I looked differently. I had very, very short hair. I had a beard. I didn't have a beard. I had long hair, whatever, because I'm going on with my life over the course of the 9 years that they did it, and I did sporadically throughout, and I was doing other jobs. And so then I get called in, and I'd look differently. Anyway, one of the first times, there was one episode where Jerry thought that I was molesting him, right? That he was in my dental chair. He was upset that I had a penthouse pet dental hygienist. You know, what is he, Caligula? It's not right. And so. The script called for me to the shtickle of fluoride, and that's a different one when I was converted to Judaism for the jokes, right? But this one was where I molested him, or I should say, allegedly. And so the script called for me to ask my assistant for the nitrous oxide. And, you know, I take the laughing gas and on Jerry, and he goes out, and as I'm lowering his chair, I say, you know, sweet dreams, you know. And he's worried. Well, after we rehearsed the scene, Jerry left, and Larry David and everybody left, and I remained on the set, as I always do, just to try to get more and more comfortable with the environment, handling the equipment and the stool and where I was going to be and knowing where things were, because this was supposed to be my office, so I had to make it my own, right? So I'm doing that, and as I'm going through the scene and thinking about things, I hear, hey, you know what would be funny? And I look around, and there's a ladder, and I look up on top of the ladder, and there's a guy, an electrician, adjusting a lamp. And I, what? Are you talking to me? He goes, yeah. It'd be funny if after you asked for the nitrous oxide, you took a hit of it first before you gave it to Jerry. And I said, oh my God, that is very, that's really funny. Yeah. So I waited till we were taping. Nurse, may I have the nitrous oxide? Yeah, and she hands it to me and I go, oh, that's good. And before I can put it on Jerry, Jerry cracks up and bends over, laughing. Even Larry David, who doesn't laugh, he acknowledges funny, but he doesn't laugh. He goes, that's very funny. Good, yeah. No, wait, Wait, come in a minute later, then it's funny. Here we go. You come down the hall. Now, I might sound like I'm doing more of Bernie Sanders than Larry David. It's kind of ingrained in the head now. But he would just go, that's very funny. Okay, Jerry, don't laugh. Jerry, stop laughing. Stop laughing. And he would yell at him, Jerry, we've got to move on. Stop laughing. And Jerry is like, so you see takes in the show? You look now, and you look at any episode, and you see Jerry, like, with this plastered-on smile. That's the take they had to use because he wasn't laughing. He's just smiling. You know, he's just smiling. It's like, that's good enough. We got to move on. So I did that, and we must have done that little bit 14 times because as soon as we did our dialogue, and I would go, nurse, and then Jerry would start laughing because he missed it. Jerry, stop it! Stop it! Okay, ready? Stop. And I'm not looking at him because you can't, right? And he can't look at me. And I go, nurse? And he'd get that far, and then she'd hand me the mask, and then he'd start laughing. I'd just hand it back to her, and it's like, we would just like, come on, come on. And he would say, come on. And then I'm starting to laugh and giggle. It's like, it's infectious, you know? It's like seeing someone yawn, and it's just perpetuating. And the upshot of that was like, that's so funny, that's so funny. And I go, wait, he gave it to me. The guy's not on a ladder now, but, and they, every head turned toward this guy, and there he is, and he just goes. So you never know where a great idea is going to come from. And that's been my motto now as I go in and I produce. It's best idea wins. So I don't care where it comes from. Just bring it.
I really appreciate all you've done, Brian, and it's wonderful. But nobody said anything about suspended suspense. And I'm wondering if we can expect it again soon.
Suspended suspense. Okay, you're referring to, at first I went, what is that? Because I got to tell you, I don't know many of the things that I've done. People have to tell me or I have to look on IMDb to go, did I really do an episode of Matlock? Oh my God, I did. Wow. Suspended Suspense is Jimmy Fallon. Is that the one? Yeah. Doing this sketch where Jimmy and I are suspended in midair doing a soap opera, and it was like the silliest little thing. And when they pitch it, you go, oh, I don't know, that sounds, but well, let's take a chance. And then it becomes this silly fun. So yeah, we were up in the air, suspended, trying to act melodramatic, and it was very funny. Yeah, I guess you can Google it. Yeah. Thanks.
Briefly, what show did you meet your wife on? I love this.
Oh, doing the rounds, my wife is, she's retired now, but she was an actor, and I met her when I was 29 years old on a show that some of you will remember, a really terrible show called Airwolf.
Terribly awesome.
Really, applause? Really? This show starred a helicopter. It was a helicopter, Jan Michael Vincent, and Ernie Borgnine. Poor Jan Michael Vincent is just a wreck, but Ernie Borgnine was a sweetheart, a true professional, a very, very, very kind man. But the helicopter was Airwolf. So can you imagine now being in a room and you're a writer and you have you're charged with the responsibility of coming up with a storyline involving a helicopter for 22 episodes a year. It's like, oh my, how they put themselves in a box. So we're shooting this scene. And if you're a guest star making the rounds as I did as an actor, in those days, all the series regulars were all the good guys. So everybody coming on as a guest star was either, if you're a man, the bad guy, or if you're a woman, the victim. So those horrible shows in the 80s and 90s, oh, God. So anyway, I get on this show, and I'm the bad guy, the main bad guy, and we're hijacking and kidnapping people and a sorority group, and, you know, it's like a reunion of sorority sisters, and one of the women in there is this is this really, really pretty woman and talented named Robin. And I had a girlfriend at the time. She had a boyfriend at the time. So it gave us permission to be able to flirt and have fun with each other without anything happening, because that's who I am. So, and that's who she is. So we were like, hey, you're cute. Yeah, I don't know. I held a gun to her head and threatened to kill her or in time potentially date her. So I gave her the choice, gave her the option. And that's what we met. That was over 30 years ago. And we've been together since, so that's great.
Nice. Sir, please.
Thank you. My wife and I just returned from Austin. We went through the LBJ Library and the LBJ Ranch, and we kept thinking about you. your performance in the play and in the movie was incredible.
Thank you.
But we were also thinking about Donald Trump. I couldn't imagine him walking through the library or the ranch. And I'd love for you to hear a conversation that you might have as LBJ with Donald Trump.
Not to put you on the spot.
LBJ would say, "What now? What the hell did you say at that on that bus? What the hell's wrong with you?" He would be appalled at the behavior. I mean, just we make light of it, but it's a serious thing. It's an awful thing, and the bar is so low that we've come like, well, you know, it's just locker room talk. It's like, no. I read an op-ed in the New York Times this morning about a guy who says, "I'm the husband of no wife, and the father of no daughters," and I think what he said was. Was absolutely abhorrent and just completely uncivil and criminally minded, you know. And he said it was interesting how people who were rejecting it always invoked that thing as if, I hate this because I have a wife and a daughter, and it shouldn't be because I have a wife and daughter that I hate this kind of behavior. It's just hating that behavior. It has no place. It's unfortunate. And I'm one. I'm voting for Hillary, but and that's just I. But it, I actually feel that our country is better when we have. Ideas that are shared and expressed from sane people. That's kind of the requirement that we should, like, you know, that we should have that. Please, sane people. I have a very, very good friend who's a very strong conservative, but he's a dear friend of mine. And we respect each other and love each other. And we debate and argue constantly without losing respect for each other's opinion. And because I know that he wants the best for the country. And he knows I want the best of the country. We just have a different way we feel it would be best. So that's what Lyndon Johnson knew best. 12 years in the House of Representatives, 12 years in the Senate, before he became vice president and then president, he knew them all. He knew how it had to be worked. He knew that if I was going to get your vote for the Civil Rights Act of 1964, I want to see what I can do to get you that bridge in Ohio. You know, it's a give and take, and that's what it took. It took real diplomacy and a desire to find common ground to be able to move forward. And we just have to hope that this ends and he goes away. That's it.
On that note, ladies and gentlemen, time has run out. It was against us. This was wonderful. The book is called A Life in Parts. Let's give it up for Bryan Cranston.
Thank you. Thank you so much for coming. It's a real joy. Coming. Thank you very much. Have a nice day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.